My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast, our final episode, not only in Deuteronomy, but also the Pentateuch as a whole. Yes, the first five books of the Bible, we have gotten through them all. Guys, thank you for all your support. I mean, this was always the plan to do this, but it's another thing to actually see it happen and to see your interactions with, you know, the text and how you're wrestling with certain things and the conversations we've had off mic about, you know, my interpretations of things and what you think what it's actually saying and stuff like that. I've thoroughly enjoyed doing this. It's given me a bigger appreciation, you know, for the law of the Israelites, and a way more appreciation for the fact that I no longer have to live under it due to the freedom that we have in Jesus Christ. So this has been a great time of exploration of the history of the Israelite people, their culture, their laws, the way that God has protected them this whole time, and watching some very interesting people grow as people. And we're going to see that at the end of these chapters, we're going to be in Deuteronomy 33 and 34 today, the final moments of Moses' life, a man who lived 120 years and had a very full life compared to some people. So thank you once again for all that you do. I really appreciate it. Continue, like, you know, just sharing the show with people, talking to me about it. It's always nice to hear what you guys have to say. But without any further ado, real quick, I do want to like give you some updates on job searches and stuff like that. I do not have anything concrete. Let me stress that part because I need to keep reminding myself that I don't. But I have some leads on some potential churches who may want me for either a youth pastor position or an associate pastor position. We shall see. I have been in contact with several pastors and search committees and elders. Some very positive things may happen. And if some of these, I mean, regardless of which one I pick, it's not going to be anywhere close to home. So it's going to be a huge adjustment I'm going to have to make. So just I ask for your prayers for, you know, wise discernment and just getting ready for this new change that'll happen. Like if it happens this month, next month, a couple months from now, I'd prefer sooner, but you know, it's not my timing. It's his. And I'm very grateful to be given what I have. So just thank you all for who have been praying for me, and I ask that you continue to do so. So now, without any further ado, let us get into Scripture today. We're going to be in Deuteronomy 33 starting off. We're going to be going through verses 1 through 7. This is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the people of Israel before his death. He said, "The Lord came from Sinai and dawned from Seir upon us. He shone forth from Mount Paran. He came from the 10,000s of holy ones with flaming fire at his right hand. Yes, he loved his people. All his holy ones were in his hand, so they followed in your steps, receiving direction from you. When Moses commanded us a law as a possession for the assembly of Jacob, thus the Lord became king in Jeshurun, when the heads of the people were gathered, all the tribes of Israel together. Let Reuben live and not die, but let his men be few. And this he said of Judah, 'Hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him into his people. With your hands contend for him, and be a help against his adversaries.'" So much like Jacob before him, with some of the final words to come out of his mouth, Moses spends his time blessing the people of Israel. Jacob did it to his sons, so they would grow and become the tribes that we see today. Moses, who had written down exactly what Jacob did, perhaps inspired by that, or maybe even told by God to do this, chooses to bless the people. And this is a man who knows these people better than anyone else. He knows their shortcomings. He knows their faults, but he also knows their successes. And he also knows that God loves them and God wants the best for them. So this is an encouragement to them. Now, some of you may be asking, I know where this story goes. How do we know what Moses said here? That's a very good question. And it's one worthy of an answer. My answer is, I don't know, but I have an idea. You know why I say I don't know? Because it's not explicitly said in the text where we are getting this information from. There are ideas that have been thrown around. You have the more liberal progressive idea of this is written hundreds of years after the fact, and this is someone making up mythology, or maybe even transcribing something that someone written down or orally had written down. Goodness gracious, use English here. Orally had spoken down the generations to the people. Then eventually they got to the point where they wrote it down. Gosh, why is English such a hard language? Anyways, I don't take that idea. I think it misconstrues scripture. I think it makes scripture the invention of man. And really has no place being believed in if it's made up by someone else, or even if it's brought down from someone who just orally spoke it a while and then they put their own spin on it. I mean, that means it's not complete. That means there's fabrications involved in it. And I ain't about that. I'm about the literal truth. I'm about the absolute authority of God and his inerrant scripture to bring it to the person he's intending it to write. Therefore, they can be the ones to write it down, that he has told them to do so. No one just said, I'm going to put this down. No, they're directed by God to do so. So that is that one side of things. There's another where there's the idea that Moses himself wrote this down before he left to go and die. You know, Moses was a prophet. He could have done this knowing where he was going to be, and God could have shown him exactly what would have happened. So he could have written that down explicitly. Like, sure, okay, I can get kind of behind that idea. There's also the idea that Moses wasn't actually alone when he died. This is more, how to put this down, like from an absence of evidence kind of place of, well, it doesn't say that there wasn't anyone else with him. I'm fairly certain in these two chapters when he died. So Joshua or Eleazar or, you know, Joe Bob from Asher could have been up there and hearing Moses' final words say, oh, jot that down. Like, sure, that's a possibility, but I prefer not to speak out of the absence of a thing. So while that is a possibility, I'm not real big on it. Then the final one, which is where I more land, is the idea that after Moses died, God spoke to Joshua or Eleazar or someone of authority who was literate and was able to write this down and said, here's what Moses said. Here's how Moses died. Add this to everything else that Moses himself wrote. So you will be a co-author in a sense that you're writing the last part here. People have differing views on that. We don't know, is my answer. So all that to say, this has been handed down to us for a reason. Regardless of who was the one who wrote it down, they were directed by God to do so. Why? So that we see where Moses' heart was at the end of his life, and we see where God's heart is at this moment in history. And where is it? Where are those hearts focused? On the people of Israel and wishing to bless them and not curse them and bring them wealth and glory and success and families and homes and prosperity because God and Moses loved them. It could have been so easy for Moses to have given up. He was with these people for so long, seeing them whine and complain and cause rebellions and die and get sick and bring snakes into the assembly. Because God was having to punish them because of what they were doing and how they were not believing well. But Moses doesn't break. Yeah, there's a reason he's dying here. It's because he did break at the point where he struck the rock instead of speaking to it as God commanded. But he did not break completely. This is still a man who loves these people, even when they themselves do not deserve it. And if that's not a quality of a godly man, I don't know what else is. Because very beginning here, he is explicitly called Moses, the man of God. You know who gets called that? Someone who's a man of God. If it's actually in scripture, yeah, we can say it. We can throw that word around, those phrases around as much as we want. It doesn't make it true. We see the evidence here for why Moses is a man of God. And I think later on, the only time we really see it frequently used, I'm sure there are other people that it's ascribed to, but really we look at Elijah and Elisha in their ministry as prophets. Later on in 1st and 2nd Kings, they're described as a man of God. Why? Because they're doing the work. They're following God with their whole heart. They're trying their best. They're working to lead other people to him. They're ministering to people in need, calling out evil. And Moses did all of these things. This is a huge compliment. This is God talking about his servant, having it written down by someone else, more than likely, to describe his servant. Said, look, yeah, you're being punished for what you did because you're not going to be able to go into land. But guess what? You're still my man through and through, Moses. And people throughout the generations from here on out are going to know that. It is 3,500-ish years since the events of the Exodus. Once again, depending on when you date it. But people are calling Moses a man of God. How many other people in history has this been true of? And yet he's explicitly singled out. Why is that? Because God had something to say about this. He had something to say about the fact that he loved his servant Moses. Yes, Moses did what he wasn't supposed to when he struck the rock, but God is still in his mercy going to give him something and go beyond what he said he would give. And God, I'm fairly certain, never said, hey, when you die, I'm going to tell people how great you were and that you're a man of God through and through. Like, no, God, I'm fairly certain God never says that. But he does it anyway because he loves his servant and he wants other people to know how great Moses is and that everything he did, it meant something. So looking at what happens here, we need to keep that context in mind. Like, this is essentially, as Moses is about to bless the people of Israel, this is kind of almost a eulogy in many respects to Moses, God allowing this to be written down on his behalf to show, look, you did the work. Good and faithful servant. Get on in. You did what you were supposed to do for the most part. And guess what? There's not a single one of us who can say we always listen to God. It ain't me, and I know it ain't you, but I know it definitely is not me. And yet, at the end of my time on this planet, when I am in front of him, yeah, he's going to be listening off. You did this, you did this, you did this. But guess what? You also said yes to me. You also submitted yourself to me, my good and faithful servant. And this is wonderful. It's stupendous. And that's something we need to be mindful of in all of this, is that Moses is being rewarded here, even though he's a flawed human being. But guess what? There's not a single one of us that deserves anything. And God chooses to shower his affections anyways. And Moses is going to receive that. But then he doesn't make it about himself. He chooses with his last words not to say, me, Moses, I'm so great. He looks at Israel and he blesses them. Look at what he says to them. Let Reuben live and not die, but let his men be few. Reuben, as we've covered throughout the Pentateuch, was the firstborn son of Jacob. By every right, he should have been the one who got his inheritance and everything else. But then you saw what Reuben did by sleeping with one of his brother's mothers and his father's concubine. And he lost that. Well, you think, well, we'll just get rid of him then. No, God doesn't give up on him. He doesn't give up on the tribe of Reuben either. Now, they're not going to be great, the tribe of Reuben. What Moses is saying here is like, look, you're going to live. but your men are going to be few. You're not going to be remarkable. And God has the ability to say this through Moses because Reuben doesn't deserve anything. Reuben deserved to never be a tribe at all. So God allowing them to be small in number but alive is a huge blessing, a huge sign of mercy. So if I'm remembering my studies correctly, throughout the entire Bible, Old and New Testament, I can't think of a single person from the tribe of Reuben who becomes a great man or a great woman. Maybe I'm forgetting someone, but I'm sure there's no judge that comes from Reuben. There's no king that comes from Reuben. No great warrior that comes from Reuben that we hear about. As far as like being noteworthy, I'm sure there were some nice, good people there. I'm sure capable people, but they're just kind of there. It's kind of like Simeon. Simeon, you're going to notice in this chapter, is not mentioned at all. And there are differing reasons behind different scholars for why they think that is. Some people lump them together with Judah because that's essentially what happens later on in Israelite history. They kind of like merge together. And the tribe of Simeon doesn't like stop existing, but they become like this entity that's really might as well just be Judah. There are others who say that, once again, because of Simeon's sins, that he's not brought up and his tribe isn't brought up here, but I don't really get that because Levi's brought up here, Reuben's brought up here, Judah, despite his sins, is brought up here, and God still used Judah to bring the Messiah to the world. So we simply don't know is the answer. But maybe there's something striking that the people of Simeon needed to hear in the absence of not being spoken about. Everyone else is getting blessings, but we aren't. Well, what's that about? Maybe we need to step up to the plate. Maybe we need to earn things a little more. Maybe we need to be a little better about who we are. Is that the motivation behind this? I don't know. Once again, it's not explicitly stated, so I cannot stand and say that's absolutely what God intended with this. And I don't want to lie to you. I don't want to be like, well, because I think it's right, therefore it must be. Like, we simply don't know. And a large part of maturing into faith is being able to say, I don't know, but I trust God. And look, that's a small detail. This is no big smoking gun. It's like, ha-ha, God didn't mention Simeon, therefore the whole Bible is not true. It's like, that, I don't know of anyone who'd make that argument because it's a stupid argument. But then again, there are people who make other stupid arguments about the Bible. But it's something you have to wrestle with. If you're actually paying attention to everything that's going on here, you have to ask yourself the question, why these tribes and why not this one? And at the end of the day, since we do not have a clear-cut answer, we also have to say, I don't know. I can speculate. I can put my best foot forward, but I cannot tell you as an absolute, and you know I love my absolutes here, as an absolute, this is why it is. And it would be very disingenuous of me to just gloss over it. I could have just gone forward, and most of you would have said nothing because, I mean, do you have all the tribes memorized? Or they said, wait a minute, are you missing someone? And you would have gone, this one, and then you've forgotten about it and then done something else. But I want to be open and honest with you. I want to give you what I feel you deserve. And that's the totality of what is in this book. That is why I go on for as long as I do, because I'm exhaustively looking through things. And even then, there are things I go back later on and go, I could have added this, and that hour and 40 minute episode could have been 2 hours or what have you. And that's why I'm glad I'm kind of using you as my guinea pigs right now for when I eventually do go into ministry somewhere else. So that, okay, I thought I could cover these chapters in a smaller amount of time. Therefore, I'm going to have to amend things and learn what to take out and what to keep in. Because guess what? Especially with youth, if that's where I go, they're not going to sit there for 40 minutes. They're not wired to do so. Even adults get a little antsy and wibbly wobbly in their seats and going, oh, man, when's lunch? Because you got to know your audience. And so podcasting, it's great. Most of the time, you just listen to this while you're out and about or in the car or what have you and sitting down. So I can go on for as long as I do. So this teaches me, that's how long I went with the information I had. Therefore, if I do this later on, what do I keep? What do I take out? Because you got to amend your preaching to your audience. A little tangent there, but it's fine. Moving on to the second tribe mentioned here is the tribe of Judah. Now, Judah is the single most important tribe in Israel. Judah is the one God says that his Messiah is going to come from. It's one where he says the greatest leader of Israel is going to come from. But Moses only gives them this one verse. Hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him into his people. With your hands, contend for him, and be a help against his adversaries. What's going on there? It's like, isn't Judah supposed to be more important than that? Well, let's look at the context of everything that's going on here. Every tribe is being told something specific to them. Hear the voice of Judah, O Lord. Bring him into his people. Contend for him. Be a help against his adversaries. Judah is going to have a lot of adversaries. Israel as a whole is going to have a lot of adversaries, but Judah is going to have more than most because there's going to be civil wars, because there's going to be rebellions, because there's going to be a split of Israel and Judah into separate nations. And then they're going to be oppressed from all sides by Egypt, by Ammon, by Moab, by Edom, the Philistines, so on and so forth. Then eventually Assyrians and Babylonians. They're going to have a lot of adversaries because they're the most important tribe. So Moses is saying, look, God, be a help to them against their adversaries and let Judah be the voice. Hear Judah's voice, Lord, and bring him into his people. Why? Because if Judah is using its voice well, the other tribes, especially when David becomes king and the Davidic line is established, they're going to have the temple there. And if Judah is using its voice wisely, the people are going to be coming there to sacrifice and be closer to the Lord. So it doesn't sound like there's a lot in here, but if you actually dive into the text, you're going to see, oh, Judah's super important. Yeah, it only gets one verse, but that one verse is saying a lot. And once again, these actual verses were not in the original text. This is an example of good church tradition where scholars along the way said, man, there's a lot of words in this book. You know what would be easier? If we gave them chapters and we gave them numbers next to them that we ascribed verses to. Because you know what's easier to look up? Verses. Versus looking up things that go, oh man, it's somewhere in Ephesians. It's in one of those Psalms. This is a blessing from God, and thank God for that. Next up, 8 through 11. And of Levi, he said, give to Levi your Thummim and your Urim to your godly one, whom you tested at Massa, with whom you quarreled at the waters of Meribah, who said of his father and mother, I regard them not. He disowned his brothers and ignored his children. For they observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach Jacob your rules and Israel your law. They shall put incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar. Bless, O Lord, his substance, and accept the work of his hands. Crush the loins of his adversaries, of those who hate him, that they rise not again. Now, probably your second most important tribe, which really should have been the first in certain respects, is the tribe of Levi. Why? Because they too had lost the birthright of the firstborn. Well, this would have been second, thirdborn son. If the succession had gone away, it did, but Simeon and Levi did the way they did, and they slaughtered us Canaanites meaninglessly and cruelly. In a way that God had not commanded them to do. So that God, oh, he just hates those Canaanites. He's like, no, he loved them. And there was punishment for killing, murdering people needlessly. But Levi, as part of that punishment, the tribe is going to thrive, but not own land, not be in charge of the government or the army. They're to be priests to the people. They're to look after them. And so Moses, in his blessing, is warning them, I have seen how you have led the people astray before, O tribe of Levi, that I come from, by the way. Do not make the same mistakes of the past. Lead the people into righteousness. Teach Jacob your rules and Israel your law. Why? So that the people of Israel would be blessed because they're doing what they're supposed to be doing because they were taught correctly. That is why we are taught these things. That is why we have Sunday school. That is why we have children's ministry. That is why we have youth college ministries. And then why does why you show up every Sunday, hopefully, to a church, whether online or physically? Because you need to be taught. I need to be taught. Why? Because if I'm not taught these things, I will not know them. Yeah, there's a general revelation we all have that we know of. Well, I feel bad when I stole that thing, or I feel bad when I lied about that. Yeah, sure. But I need to be told why it's bad. I need to be told why I am a screwed up human being and why I need a savior. The world is not going to teach me that because the world does not love me. Therefore, if you want to be taught well, you go to the experts. You go to people who know their stuff, who are willing to say, I know this, or also willing to say, I'm not sure, or I don't know. A good teacher of any sort, your sciences, English, math, what have you, is going to be able to say those things. You're going to say, look, we know, as far as we're aware, the speed of light is a constant, but we're not capable right now of actually, you know, getting there ourselves and propelling ourselves forward at light speed. We're not ready for the Star Wars, Star Trek of it all. I don't know how that works. A good scientist will tell you, I don't know, but I'm working on it. A good mathematician will tell you, hey, we've got this unsolved theorem. I don't know how it works. I'm going to teach it because it's important, because if that breakthrough happens, it's going to increase our knowledge of how to mathematically understand the world and all these processes that I don't understand because math isn't my shtick, but I'm glad that they do. In the same way, a good teacher in the church is going to be there for your benefit, to help enrich you and bring you closer to him. Why? Because we're not going to be able to do it on our own. Yeah, there are times that there are things that I can only do when I'm on my own. but I cannot stay there all my life. I need to be a part of ministry with people. I need to be in community with them, learning under someone more capable than I, and then teaching people who are not as capable as I, loving them well, not because I'm superior to them, not because I'm just smarter and better and wiser to them, but because I love them and I want to see them be better. I want to see them grow. I want to see them be smarter than me. Look, I'm fine with that. If it means you're better than me, be better than me. And that is a humbling thing to say, because the Christian of the past wouldn't have said that. And so Moses is telling Levi, do these things, bless the people through your actions, through teaching them the law. Therefore, when they do these things, Lord, bless them so that they can continue to do that. Why? Because they're going to have adversaries too, in a different way than Judah will. Levi, their greatest adversaries are going to be people who misinterpret the law, who lead people into sin, and people who want to lead the people into worshiping other gods. That triple threat is what brings Israel down every single time. They don't interpret the law correctly. They have someone leading them into sin, or they have someone leading them to worship of false gods, and then they go follow those false gods, and then the Levites join them. The people who aren't supposed to be doing that, out of everyone, you'd think it'd be the people who actually knew their stuff. But it turns out that just because you're intelligent and wise doesn't mean that you stop being a human being. If you look at cults across the world, I mean, the stereotype is that cults just go after the disenfranchised and the stupid and the layabout society. And yeah, that happens. But look, if you actually study them, see how many intelligent people, doctors, lawyers, politicians, what have you, have joined a cult because it made them feel like they belonged, or it gave them the impetus to say that I get to do what I want. Being smart, being wise does not mean that you're free from sin. It happens to people who believe some whacked out things in the world. See, we need to be careful. How? By having competent teachers who look after us and take care of us by leading us into spiritual truth. That is how we avoid false ideas about the Trinity. That is how we avoid false ideas about God and Jesus and salvation and what we're supposed to do as a church. When you have competent and good teachers. So that's why Moses takes his time. He takes a little more words, uses a little more words to bless Levi specifically because of how important they're going to be on the spiritual side of things. And that's something we need to pay attention to. Next up, we're going through verses 12 through 17. Of Benjamin, he said, the beloved of the Lord dwells in safety. The high God surrounds him all day long and dwells between his shoulders. And of Joseph, he said, blessed by the Lord be his land with the choicest gifts of heaven above and of the deep that crouches beneath, with the choicest fruits of the sun and the rich yield of the months, with the finest produce of the ancient mountains and the abundance of the everlasting hills, with the best gifts of the earth and its fullness, and in favor of him who dwells in the bush. May these rest on the head of Joseph, on the pate of him who is prince among his brothers. A firstborn bull, he has majesty, and his horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he shall gore the peoples, all of them to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. Starting with Benjamin here. Benjamin is a very small tribe, relatively speaking. If you actually look at the land portion that they get, it's very tiny. And it gets even tinier when, yeah, they attack Jerusalem, but they didn't actually succeed in holding it because they weren't following God as well as they should have. And so later on, Judah is going to come in and take that land for their own when David becomes king. But notice what they're called here. Beloved of the Lord dwells in safety. Benjamin was one of Jacob's favorite sons because, unfortunately, as a father, he played favorites. After Joseph was presumed to be dead, Benjamin became top dog. He's the one that daddy doted on. And God, who is a much better father, is going to dote on Benjamin in a way that Benjamin actually deserves because Benjamin is tiny. The high God, that word there, the high God, I forgot to look it up. But the idea being is like, look, I'm above you. I'm looking out for you. I'm watching out for you in ways that you can't even comprehend. And he looks at Benjamin and protects him, because look where Benjamin is sandwiched in Israel. If you're looking at that map, it's got Judah right next to it. And then Ephraim above it, two of the largest and most prosperous tribes in Israel. How better defended could you be by having Judah and Ephraim above and below you, watching out for you, making sure that you were okay? That's a huge blessing. And God's going to protect Benjamin. And not only that, he's even going to allow someone from the tribe of Benjamin to become a king. Even though, look how small they are. Look how weak they are. God still chooses them and watches out for them. And even when the tribe split, Benjamin is still protected because they remain with Judah, who does not originally create the two golden calves that Ephraim would do through Jeroboam the first. They remain with Judah. And yeah, they're led into apostasy just as much as Judah is at certain times in their history. But for the most part, they're protected and they are not taken away as captives when the Assyrians come in and take Israel away, the 10 tribes of the north. So look at God's favor at them. Wow, that's a great God, that high God surrounding him all day long. And then Moses goes from there to Joseph, and he puts Ephraim and Manasseh together, and he's speaking the best about him. You say, well, what about what Ephraim and Manasseh do later on? It's like, well, yeah, sure. That's in his head, but look at how God is going to bless these tribes. At the start, they're going to have some great land to work with. Manasseh is to the point where it has to be split up into two different tribes, one tribe on this side of the Jordan, the other side on the other tribe of the Jordan, other side of the Jordan. And you have Ephraim, who really is the biggest rival to Judah, as a shining only a sign of God's favor to Joseph, who he said is going to be special. He's going to be above his brothers. Not in the sense that it's always going to be that way, but God is still going to show special favor to them, even when they really don't deserve it. And he's going to make them grow. And it's a very beautiful thing, even knowing where they're going to end up, seeing how God favors these people, how he loves them. And we'll go from there to verses 18 through 25. And of Zebulun, he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar in your tents. They shall call peoples to their mountain. There they offer a right sacrifice, for they draw from the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. So Zebulun and Issachar, they ain't some of the most important tribes of Israel. I think there's one or two judges that come from them, maybe one from each, or maybe just one, but they're also kind of small. But God is still going to bless them. How? Well, they're right next to the Sea of Galilee. It's not really focused on a lot in the Old Testament, but the Sea of Galilee is a huge part of Israel's development, of finding resources, and they're also going to take bounty from the sea. They're not going to have the territory around there because they're going to fail at their task to take the whole land, but they're still going to gain access to it later on. And it's going to come to them, and they're going to enrich the whole of Israel by where they're at and how they can have trade with other nations and bring that into Israel proper. So even these small nothing tribes, God is saying, look, I'm still going to be out there looking out for you. When you do the right things, when you offer the right sacrifices, notice it specifies right sacrifices because there's a wrong way to do it. When you do these things, guess what's going to happen? Every time I said I bless you, it's going to happen. I just realized something. Did I stop at 19? That certainly sounds like me. Sorry, I'm getting old in my old age. I think I stopped at 19. I said 18 through 25, then I stopped. Okay, we're going to continue to 20 through 25. My bad. That's how competent I am. And of Gad, he said, blessed be he who enlarges Gad. Gad crouches like a lion. He tears off arm and scalp. He chose the best of the land for himself, for there a commander's portion was reserved. He came with the heads of the people, while Israel, he executed the justice of the Lord and his judgments for Israel. And of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's cub that leaps from Bashan. Of Naphtali, he said, O Naphtali, sate it with favor and full of the blessing of the Lord, possess the lake and the south. And of Asher, he said, most blessed of sons be Asher. Let him be the favorite of his brothers, and let him dip his foot in oil. Your bars shall be iron and bronze, and as your days, so shall your strength be. I definitely did that. Oh, well. No plan survives contact with the enemy. Sometimes the enemy is yourself. So Gad, also not really one of the most important tribes of Israel. But look at how God talks about them. They're going to be on the other side of the Jordan, where they get to reap the benefits of doing so, because that is a very fertile land where there's plenty of produce to be had, of pastures to be had, that will not only enrich themselves, but all of Israel by proxy. And they delivered justice to a lot of people who they had to execute there, you know, like Og and Sihon, and other people will come that way too. We'll have Midianite raiders and Ammonites and Moabites, so on and so forth, who will try and take over this part of the land, and they're going to deliver justice to them as time goes on. Then we get to Dan. Dan, I probably mentioned it before, but Dan is one of the most frustrating tribes of Israel to follow in the history of Israel. Because if you look, when we do get to Joshua way later on, we're going to see where they're supposed to be. And they're supposed to be around the area of where some of the Philistine cities are, having access to the sea and all that. But Dan, out of all the other parts of Israel, all the other tribes who are going astray and not following after God like they should, as we see in the time of the book of Judges, they're the worst of the bunch. And I don't say that lightly. So Moses, knowing this is going to happen, some people say that's part of why he words it the way he does. It calls him a lion's cub that leads from Bashan. Bashan is the kind of part of the region where they're kind of at right now. That's, you may notice, not where Dan is supposed to be. But it's kind of where Dan ends up, and that there's a Bashan on different sides of the Jordan. And Dan is going to be taking the cities of people who weren't part of theirs to conquer, and taking advantage of weaker people because they couldn't beat the stronger Philistines. And I'm taking this as a slight against them, because that's what it seems to be. It's like, yeah, you're a cub. You're not a lion. You're weak. You're small. You're playing pretend. Like, you know what a lion's cub do? They, you know, practice hunting and taking things down. They will play with each other, their siblings and other smaller lions, but they'll also do it with their mothers and fathers, and do the whole thing and like going for the throat and stuff like that. You know, it's play, but they're not actually threats to a wildebeest, shall we say, or a zebra, what have you. They're just cubs. So there have been debates about this in the scholar world. What this actually means is like a slight against them. Is this just like, is this actually good? Is it positive? It's like, oh, you're a lion's cub. You're getting ready for things. I take it as a slight. I can't prove that. So let me step away from the Bible for a second. But knowing how Dan ends up to the point where the tribe itself isn't even mentioned in the book of Revelation as part of the 144,000, I kind of see it here of them being the weakest, really, truly the weakest. And that in order to get land of their own, they had to kill people who weren't even people they were supposed to kill. And maybe Moses sees this as a prophet, which, as noted before, he is one. So it's entirely possible. But yeah, for Dan, it's kind of sad how they end up. I mean, they could have, if they'd just done their job, been fine. Then we get to Naphtali. Also, not one of the most important tribes, but is actually bordering the Sea of Galilee in a way that is going to allow Zebulun and Issachar to gain access to the Sea of Galilee. They're going to be hugely wealthy because they're the ones right there. And they're going to be full of the blessing because it's great to have a source of food, of water. Because, by the way, there's that whole Dead Sea down there. It's, I mean, it exists, but it's not really useful in the same way that the Sea of Galilee is going to be. Look how favored you are by God. I put you right here. So you can be a help not only to yourselves, but also to the tribes around you, that they're going to benefit from you benefiting. So you're sated with favor. I can't speak today. And sometimes this we got to take. Like, look, some people out there, we're not the most notable people in the world. I am not a New York Times bestselling author. I don't have to be. I would like to be, but I'm not. I'm just doing my work. And sometimes it's nice to be sated with favor, even if it's not the favor of man. And Naphtali sated with that favor, full of the blessing of the Lord. Then we get to Asher. Asher is also one of those tribes that doesn't fully get access to all the cities it was supposed to conquer. Then again, that's true of all the tribes. But Asher is kind of glaring too, because if you look at where they're supposed to be, they're supposed to take Tyre and Sidon. They're supposed to take out the Phoenicians. And they fail utterly at that task. So why are they blessed? Because even when they fail, they still have access to the sea. They still have the ability to trade with the people that they were supposed to wipe out and gain goods and services that could only come from them. The Phoenicians were the greatest traders and merchants of the ancient world, bar none. They searched all of the Mediterranean. There's evidence that they may have gone even further beyond that. It's a huge speculative thing. Not every scholar is willing to say, yeah, they might have even made it to the Americas, or they went down to the southern tip of Africa. We're not entirely sure, but we do know for sure they were wealthy. They were truly blessed as a nation, because they look at the size of Phoenicia, and then look at all the colonies that they spread across the Mediterranean, to the point where Carthage becomes one of the most important nation states of that time until it's taken out by Rome in the Third Punic War. So all those places they're going out to, they're bringing stuff back and they're trading with people who want what they have because they don't have access to it. So Asher, by proxy, is going to have some of that wealth, because while they failed, God still blesses them by giving them access to things that other people wouldn't have access to. And it's through Asher that those things would then trickle down to the rest of Israel. So they are blessing their brothers. They are most blessed of sons. So maybe he should be the favorite of his brothers, because they get things that they wouldn't normally be able to have access to. Because the Israelites as a nation, outside of the time of King Solomon and a little bit of Jeroboam II, they're not a seafaring people. They mostly stick to the land, and they'll trade like with other nations around them on foot, but they're not sending out fleets. Outside of, once again, of King Solomon, who establishes like Ezion Geber and other ports to send out fleets to acquire things from other nations. So Asher is most favored, most blessed in that circumstance. We compare to 26 through 29. There is none like God, O Jeshurun, who rise to the heavens to your help, through the skies in his majesty, the eternal God in your dwelling place. And underneath are the everlasting arms. And he thrust out the enemy before you and said, destroy. So Israel lived in safety. Jacob lived alone in a land of grain and wine, whose heavens drop down dew. Happy are you, O Israel. Who is like you, a people saved by the Lord? The shield of your help and the sword of your triumph. Your enemies shall come fawning to you, and you shall tread upon their backs. Now, if you remember from 32, the term Jeshurun there was used earlier in 33 as well, it means the upright one. It is often used sarcastically, but it can have a positive lens. This is a more positive take on the word, because most of the time when God uses it to describe Israel, it's done in a sarcastic fashion. Oh, you're the upright one, all right. You always listen to me. You always do what you're told. But this one appears to be a very positive outlook on Israel. Look, you are the upright one. Look at the other nations. Which one of them is following me? Which one of them is submitting to my laws? Which one of them loves me? None of them do. You, O Israel, O Jeshurun, you are the upright one. And you have me. I ride through the heavens to your help. Name one other God who does that. You can't, because they either don't exist or they're not as strong as I. I am the eternal God, the self-sufficient, almighty God who needs nothing, empowers himself, exists beyond our understanding of time and space. I'm your dwelling place. You're under my everlasting arms. I am protecting you. An enemy comes against you, I say, destroy, because I want you to live in safety and live from the wealth and benefits of the land that I'm giving you. So be happy, Israel. No one else is like you in the world. Enemies are going to be like giving up everything just to get your favor because they want what I give you. And you're going to be over them if, there's always that if, you submit to me alone. That's how Moses ends. I mean, his final recorded words in chapter 33. As a final reminder to Israel to trust God alone. There is none like him. So worship him alone. And that brings us into 34. We're going to read 1 through 12, and we're going to finish the book of Deuteronomy. Then Moses went out from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah, which is opposite Jericho. And the Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, all Naphtali, the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, the Negeb and the plain that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees as far as Zoar. And the Lord swore to him, this is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to your offspring. I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of the Lord. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were undimmed. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab, 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses were ended, and Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and the wonders that the Lord sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh, to all his servants, and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of Israel. And here is where we see God displayed and how he treats his servant Moses, this man of God. Moses does not deserve a single thing that happens in this chapter. Not a single thing. Moses deserves none of it. Moses deserves to never see the land that God promised the people. Moses deserved to have been killed outright by God for what he did, for leading the people astray. And not following his directions and giving into his pride and anger. But what does God do with his servant? Keeps him alive for 120 years, not once being slowed down by that age. That is impossible without God being behind it. 120-year-old men do not cross the desert every day for 40-some years, even when he's 80, doing that, and be in a bit of health where they can see perfectly, and they can walk and move perfectly. That is impossible. The longest recorded life that we have, the last time I checked, was a 122-year-old French woman. She looked like the crypt keeper, not like a person anymore. I'm sorry. It's not fair. I probably shouldn't be wording it like that, but that's what human beings look like after 122 years on the planet. We grow old and decrepit and weak and frail and pathetic because we are finite beings who are meant to die in this world because of the presence of sin. But God, in his mercy, did not let this happen to Moses. Why? Because the people needed him. They needed him to see. They needed him to be unabated and how he moved around so that he could address problems as they needed to be addressed. And Moses is given these things, not because he's the best of the best, not because he never sinned, but because God loved him. And we need to be mindful of that. Moses did the work. He is not a perfect man by any stretch of the imagination. We've been over the entire Pentateuch. We've seen his story start in Exodus, and we see it in now in Deuteronomy. If you say at the end of his life, Moses was a perfect man, I don't know what book you're reading. But what I do see is a man of God. I do see someone who, while he himself was human and frail and pathetic at times, rose above that to serve the people, to love them, to love his God, and bring God's love and goodness into the world. Israel needed a man like him, just like they're going to need Joshua in the book of Joshua. They need strong, capable people who follow God first, and then through following God and their love for him, then love the people well. And Moses did that. And as he dies right here, we need to recognize that and thank him for his service. Those of us who are in the church, those of us who are his, we are called to act in a similar manner. When we die, there should be people saying, he did that. She did this. No one else knew about it. He just did it for me. She just did that for me. He watched over us. He taught Sunday school. When a crisis was going on in my home and I had to leave the house, she looked after my kids. Or both parents looked after the kids so I could focus on this. When I was sick, they came to my home and they looked after me. We're not all called to be the leader of a church or the leader of a group of people like Moses was, but we're all called to be servants and to love people well. And you're going to be able to love people in ways I'm never going to be able to do. Some people are great at organization. Some people are great at hospitality. And there's been people in the church, they've never once had to fear where the next meal came from. You know, maybe after a sickness or a loss of a family member or pregnancy, where you know both spouses aren't able to do anything because they're tired and they're weak and they're looking after this new life that they just had, and suddenly there's members of the church showing up and they got food, they got diapers, they're looking after these people. Why? Because they love them and because they want to do the work. Other people need time to just speak for reasons I will never understand in this world. As someone who is very misanthropic by nature, as noted several times in the show, I have become a spiritual counselor to many people, listening to their problems, empathizing with them, loving them well. If you had told me, Christian, that's what you're going to be really good at, as I was growing up in the church, I would have called you stupid. Because why would I care? Let someone else do that job. But no, it's something that I'm actually really good at, listening to people and offering advice as needed. I've had to learn that latter part a little more because I like solving things. I don't like to see people in distress and I don't want them hurt. I'm like, oh, we'll just do this. Well, that may even be true, but maybe it's not the right time. These processes that we're all going to be doing, we're going to have to figure them out, how to do them correctly, how to love people well. And Moses learned over time how to do things well. I remember back in 18, where he's trying to take it all on himself, and Jethro's like, dude, you can't do this. You got to have people you can delegate these tasks to. You can focus on the other things that matter. Not to say that these things don't matter, but that if you're the only one doing this, you're going to run yourself thin. And maybe you wouldn't have struck that rock once. You're probably like three or four times. So learn from Moses' example here. Learn that he's not a perfect human being. We're not perfect human beings, but we can still be men and women of God, loving him alone to the point where when he dies, no one knows where he's at because God buries him, but they weep and mourn for him because they loved him, because they knew how much he had done for their sake. Now, I was just at a funeral for a family member. I think he and dad were, second, third. I don't pretend to understand. It was explicitly stated the second cousin or first cousin removed or what have you in front of my face. And I don't remember none of it, but I know this man was a pastor. He led his flock well. He loved people well. And there were so many people who had so many kind things to say about this is how he loved them. This is when he called them when they needed the most. And he didn't even know that. He was just looking out for his flock well. And you could see, yeah, it was a time of mourning, but there was also a time of rejoicing because everyone there knew where he was now. And it was a tremendous service, one of the best I'd ever been at. And I hope that's true of all of us, is that we can have that at the end. when our time comes, there should be people saying at my funeral, man, I'm going to miss him because of this. Or he reached out to me in the middle of this. He didn't know what was going on, but he just loved me. Or while I was dealing with this crisis, he counseled me. Or as I was sick in the hospital, he showed up and watched over me. Because if there's not, that sounds like it's my fault. That sounds like I didn't do enough. I wasn't looking after people as well as I should have. And yeah, I'm not going to be able to do everything. I can't put too much on myself. There's enough on my shoulders. But when that day does come, hopefully a very long time from now, I hope there's people saying those things about me. Not because it's like, oh, let's make it all about me. It's like, no, it's like the impact that I had, the people that I helped bring to faith in ways that I hope there are stories told that I didn't even know that they existed because I did the right thing. And it affected that person in ways that they never told me, but it changed something about their lives and they lived it differently. But I don't also want to skip over how this ends. Deuteronomy. It doesn't end with Moses' death. Just like at a funeral, it doesn't end with the death of that person. Because there are people who are always impacted by that person. And Joshua is our man, full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the people of Israel obeyed him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. Joshua gets to be top dog next because he put in the work. Because he saw how to lead his people well, and now he's going to go and lead them well. Now, we're not going into the book of Joshua next. We're going into the book of Matthew. And if you don't know why, I explained it a couple episodes ago, but I'll explain it again. I want to go through the Gospels again. Now, we started with Luke, my favorite Gospel. But as I was like planning things in the future, it's like, yeah, we're a long ways away from actually getting to the New Testament if we just kept going through the Old Testament. But when we got to the point of the New Testament, I didn't want to go, okay, it's time for Matthew, then Mark, then John. Now, you could do that. I've seen pastors do it. But I wanted there to be some space in between. It's where we go, well, it's been 2-3 years since we've been through the Gospel of Luke. Now it's time for the Matthew. And then after that, we're going to be going through all the historical books. Then when those are done, we're going to go through the book of Mark. Then we're going to go through the wisdom literature. And when those are done, we're going to go through the Gospel of John. Then we do the prophetic books. And from there, we'll go to Acts and finish off the New Testament. You know, assuming I get to live that long. I hope so. I don't know the future. But I do know that it's my responsibility as a leader, even in a small way like this, to lead you well, to guide you well. And that's why I plan these things like I do. I think that this is the best idea. Maybe it's not, but it feels right to me. And I want us to get into the book of Matthew, and I would see there is a ton of good wisdom that is gifted to us in this book. I mean, the Sermon on the Mount alone, I'm actually going to have to split that up. You know me, I like to do at least a chapter. I'm going to do what I should have done with the Gospel of Luke and the first chapter there, and I should have split that up. When we get to the Beatitudes, I'm going to have to split that up more than likely. My instinct is going to be, no, I'm going to focus on everything at once. I'm probably going to have to change that because there's a lot of wisdom there and a lot of stuff we need to focus on that I just said in one verse. So with all that in mind, thank you all for what you do here. I appreciate it immensely. Next time we will be in Matthew chapter 1. So be prepared for that. Please get a chance to give a 5-star rating your podcasting platform of choice to help with the ratings there to help find more people. Please feel free, once again, to share the show with friends and family members. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my works at starfighterskill.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anazal Ministries Podcasting Network. You can find me specifically on Systematic Ecology, Why I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, and Some Joyful Noises. Contact me at letnothingmoviepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Noel for the editing that he does and for the music he has to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you in accordance to his will and not mine. And allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.